Darkness fell, and the next day came, and still we hid in a pile of wood beside the barn. Finally, we set out, but that night it began to snow. The snow blotted out all sound and scent. Lost, we crawled under a sweep of pine boughs, and I curled myself around my sister, who is so much smaller. In the morning, she died. When the snow stopped, I saw that we had sheltered beneath the great pine at the top of our ridge. We had been within sight of home. The image she shared then, her sister's frozen corpse at the base of the mighty pine, seemed to exhaust her. Why do we have no family, brother? Runt turned to Pax. Because of the humans, we have no family. Bristle turned her golden eyes on Pax, inviting a challenge. If he could have, he would have made her know every kindness of every day with his boy. But the hatred she had for humans was deep and fair. Instead, he offered his cheek in sympathy. Bristle turned away and ordered her brother into the den. Chapter 12.
You coming in, or am I just holding the door open for the flies?
Peter dropped his pack. He rebalanced himself on the crutches and stared at the log cabin. These trees grew here. It hadn't been a question, but Vola nodded and pointed uphill.
Spruce, from the top of Mason's Ridge. Lincoln logs. Is that what you're thinking?
Sort of. But it wasn't. Peter reached out to touch one of the logs. What would it feel like to make something so consequential? To cut timbers and watch them fall out of a clear blue sky, and roll them down to a clearing, your hands sticky with sharp-scented pitch, and then to lift them into place, notched and stacked one over another. Yes, just like the toys that had been his favorite in kindergarten, the old set in the tall cardboard canister, and end up with a home. You built this?
No, before my time. Now come in. I don't have all day.
Peter still didn't move.
What are the conditions? You said you'd tell me when we got here.
Vola sighed and stepped back down onto the slab of granite that formed the front step, letting the screen door clap shut. She picked up a jar of seeds, and a cloud of birds fluttered down from the trees to surround her. She filled a feeder that hung from a corner rafter before turning to answer him.
Number one, I don't want anyone coming around here. I live by myself for a reason. You write to your grandfather and tell him whatever it takes to make sure nobody comes around here. Besides, it's only fair you let your family know you're not dead in a ditch somewhere.
Peter reared back so fast that he almost toppled over. The pain that movement caused was searing, but he bit his lip.
No, he'd come and get me. No! Condition number one, non-negotiable.
She scooped a few seeds from the jar and held out her palm. A chickadee left the feeder and settled on her fingertips. He pecked at the seeds, and when they were gone, she tossed him back into the air. She turned back to Peter.
Number two, you're going to tell me why you're carrying that bracelet.
Peter glanced down at his pack and felt his heart clench to protect what was so private.
Why? Because I'm curious about you, and you can tell a lot about a soldier by what he carries into battle.
But I'm not a soldier. I'm just going home.
Is that so? Because it sounds to me like you're headed off to fight for something in a place where there's a war.
But have it your way. You're not a soldier.
Condition two is still this. When I ask, you're going to tell me why you've brought that bracelet with you. Why that particular thing.
The truth. That's the rule here. Agreed? Peter nodded. His right foot throbbed. His left leg ached from the extra burden, and his shirt was sweat-soaked from the exertion of hobbling the 100 yards from the barn. But he stood his ground.
And number three. You're going to help me with something. I see that look. Don't worry. It's just a project needs a second person, that's all. But I'm not ready to tell you what it is yet. She picked up his backpack. Inside. It's time to get you off that foot. And I suspect you're hungry, Mr. Not Exactly Running Away From Home, No Bat Peter.
Suddenly, Peter was starving.
Still, he hesitated. He pivoted to look at the hills, which the sun was lightening to smoky blue. Pax was out there. He was still so far away.
Vola came up behind him. Peter sensed her raising a hand toward his shoulder, and then letting it fall back.
I know what you're thinking, she said, but you are not fit to go yet.
Inside, the cabin was bright and smelled faintly of smoke. Vola tapped a pine table, and Peter sat. She draped a blanket over his shoulders, then left, and came back with a plastic bag full of ice cubes. She propped his foot on a chair and wedged the ice bag against it. With a washcloth, she cleaned the blood from his hand. Finally, she passed him a cutting board with a loaf of bread and a knife on it. Peter put it down.
How long will it take? Depends on you. The woman pointed to the bread.
What, you can't use your hands either? Slice that up.
How long?
You can go when you can hike over the rough terrain on those crutches for 8 hours a day.
2 weeks, I'd guess.
6 slices.
You don't understand. He won't survive.
Vola lowered her head to glare at Peter. She yanked her thumb to the wall behind him.
Number 11.
Peter twisted around. A jumble of index cards was thumbtacked to the wall. The Gulf Stream will flow through a straw, provided the straw is aligned to the Gulf Stream and not at cross currents. He read aloud from the one with an 11 scrawled over it.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means align yourself, boy.
Align myself?
Figure out how things are and accept it.
You've got a broken foot.
Broken. The deal is, you stay until I say you're ready. I told you my conscience is stretched to its limit. So that's your choice. Stay here until I say, or go back to your grandfather's now.
You change your mind about that?
No, but then accept it, eh? Now slice the Doblemon bread.
Peter started to argue, but then closed his mouth. He wasn't staying for any 2 weeks, but obedient and helpful was the safest play for now. He ducked his head and set to work, cutting 6 thick, even slices of bread, while Vola slapped a chunk of butter into an iron skillet and snapped on a flame beneath it. Without turning around, she motioned to a shelf above the counter.
Pick yourself something.
Canning jars, stacked 3 deep, gleamed like a rainbow of liquid jewels along the length of the shelf. Peter read the plain block letters on the labels. Cherries, plums, tomatoes, blueberries, apples, pumpkin, pears, green beans, beets, peaches. Braids of dried garlic and chili peppers hung beside the shelf.
You grow all this?
Vola nodded, her back still to him. The trees that run along your stone wall are in bloom.
What are they?
Nearest the wall?
Peaches.
He pointed to a jar near the end.
Peaches,
he said.
Please, ma'am?
Vola opened a jar and handed him a fork.
There's a twig in it or something.
Vola reached into the jar, popped the stick into her mouth, sucked the syrup off, pitched the stick over her shoulder into the sink, and rolled her eyes.
Lord, cinnamon, eat.
She gathered the bread he'd cut with a curt nod of approval.
Cheddar or Swiss?
Cheddar, I guess.
Vola straightened.
You guess, boy? You don't know?
Peter shrugged and speared a peach chunk. It tasted as bright and golden as it looked. Vola seemed to be working up a whole lot more to say about the cheese issue, but then she pressed her lips together, spun around on the point of her wooden leg, and clumped out the back door. She came back in with a slab of cheese a moment later, then set to work wordlessly making sandwiches. Peter heard them sizzle as she pressed them into the hot skillet. He surveyed the cabin. It wasn't big, but it didn't feel cramped either. Sunlight flooded in through clean windows, washing the log walls in a honey glow. Two blue-striped armchairs flanked a stone fireplace, and a trunk stacked with books served as a table between them. Small barrels held lanterns, and more hung from the beams. There were photos on the mantel, a few paintings on the walls, and a basket of yarn beside the armchair. Through an open door by the fireplace, Peter saw the corner of a bed, neatly made with a yellow-checked quilt. It was a surprisingly normal home for a crazy person. Yet something was missing. Peter noticed then how quiet it was. Silent, actually, except for bird calls outside and the butter sputtering in the skillet. But that wasn't it. Not exactly. "Hey," he said as it dawned on him. "You don't have electricity." The woman flipped the sandwiches.
"As far as I know, that's not a crime in this country. Not yet, anyway."
Peter tried to think about what he would miss without electricity, but there were too many things to count. He chased out the last bit of peach, the fork rattling against the empty jar. Vola's back was still turned to him, so he lifted the jar to drain the last drops of syrup.
"But wait, how'd you get the ice?" "I've got a refrigerator out on the porch. It's gas. So's the stove and the water heater. I've got everything I need."
She set two blue plates down on the table. Peter's mouth watered at the smell of the food, but he waited. Vola wasn't finished, he sensed.
"I have more than everything I need,"
Vola sat. "I have peace here."
"Because it's so quiet?"
"No, because I'm exactly where I should be, doing exactly what I should be doing. That is peace. Eat." Peter bit into his sandwich. The cheese was hot and runny all the way through, the bread fried crisp and brown. He broke off a corner out of force of habit and was about to reach down with it when he remembered there was no fox under the table. He wondered if Pax was missing him as much as he missed his fox right now. "Don't you get lonely out here?"
"I see people. B. Booker, librarian. Robert Johnson, bus driver. I see people." She got up, brought the frying pan over, and slid another sandwich onto his plate. "Eat."
Peter ate, thinking about what she'd said about peace. When he finished, he licked the buttery crumbs from his fingers. "What do you mean, you're doing exactly what you should be doing? Do you work?"
"Of course I work. The garden is half an acre and the orchard is twice that size. I'm planting beans and okra today. Maybe get to replacing the seal on the well pump. There's always plenty to do here."
"But you don't go to a job, make any money? How do you buy things? Like all those tools in the barn, like..." He waved around the cabin. "All your stuff." Vola hoisted herself onto the counter and then held out her wooden leg and wrapped it with the spatula.
"My country pays me a little blood money every month in exchange for my leg."
She dropped the spatula into the sink and shook her head.
"A double mon deal. Turned out my leg wasn't that valuable to them. Wish they'd told me that before they sent me scouting in a minefield. Because I liked my leg. It was a good leg. Not much to look at, maybe, but it worked fine. It ran me clear into the next town when Deirdre Callanan and I set fire to her father's woodshed in sixth grade. And it kicked the smile off Henry Valentine's face when he tried to grab my butt the next year. I could go on. A leg is a very big price to pay. Every day, every single day, I wish I had it back. How come you don't get one that's more..." The woman stuck her leg out again and tugged up her cuff to assess the wooden post.
"Well, they gave me a prosthetic. A complicated piece of work. Scared the devil out of me whenever I looked down. So I made my own. It's heavy and it's clumsy, but I did some terrible things in the war. I figure I deserve to drag something around."
"You threw it away? A prosthetic leg? You just threw it away?" Peter couldn't help imagining the shocked look on some garbage collector's face.
"Of course not. I wear it.
Sometimes. Right now, it's in the garden on the scarecrow. Scares the devil out of the crows, too, apparently. She dropped off the counter and jammed a battered straw hat onto her head, as if she'd suddenly remembered this garden of hers.
I'll be back before dark. The outhouse is just beyond the two cedars, and there's a tub in the kitchen. Clean up. The porch is yours. Actually, you'll have to share it with François. Keep that leg elevated.
Who's François?
Again, Vola's short bark of a laugh startled Peter. She tipped her head toward the back door, which led out to a screened porch.
He's probably out there napping right now, lazy old thief.
She crossed to the door, looked out, and then nodded.
Come, see.
Peter levered himself off the chair and onto the crutches. Vola held the door open and waved toward a wood bin. Peter saw a pair of dark ringed eyes peering out at him. He cocked his head to get a better view, and the raccoon cocked his head back.
François Villon, named after one of the most famous thieves in history. The original was a poet as well as a thief, and such a charmer that every time they arrested him, some admirer pardoned him.
Peter grinned. He crouched to get a better look.
Hey, chuck, chuck, chuck,
he called softly, the way he always greeted Pax in the morning. The raccoon eyed him lazily for another moment, then seemed to decide he wasn't interesting, and flopped over and closed his eyes. Is he wild or tame? Vola waved the words off as if they were gnats.
I leave the porch door open, he visits when he wants to, and he's fine company. I feed him, but I don't have to. He stays fat enough on his own. We've come to a little agreement about the chicken coop. He leaves the girls alone, and I scramble him up an egg now and then. He's a companion. That's the best word.
She pointed to a beam spanning the ceiling.
Tomorrow you can do some pull-ups. But today, stay off the leg and keep it elevated. Above your heart is best.
She nodded to the refrigerator.
Keep icing it, on and off. I want the swelling down some so I can set that bone tonight. Mix a spoonful of willow bark in water every few hours for pain.
Peter nodded, then dropped into a hammock hanging from the beams, exhausted. Vola started to leave, but paused in the doorway and turned around to study him. She crossed her arms over her chest, an unreadable expression on her face.
What?
Just wondering, she said. You staying out here on the porch. What do you suppose that makes you? Wild or tame?
Chapter 13. When Pax awoke, it was late afternoon. The ache that had cramped his belly the past few days was worse, and when he tried to rise, he lost his balance for a second, his muscles trembling. He surveyed them for injury with a distanced curiosity. Once, when he'd been ill, his boy had forced a pill down his throat. Afterward, his senses had been dulled and his reactions slowed. He felt the same way now. He dropped to the cool dirt and watched as below, Gray and his mate emerged from their rests to scent the air, relieve themselves, then set off for food. Bristle sprang out from a den beside him, stopped only to order her brother to stay behind, then trotted off to hunt also. On the day he'd gotten into the car with his boy, Pax had sensed the tension and refused his morning kibble. So it had now been 3 full days since he'd eaten. Although Pax had never seen death, he understood that it awaited him if he did not find food. This thought produced no sense of urgency and drifted away. A second thought, however, that he must find his boy and see him safe, stirred him to rise again, first bracing himself on his forelegs before straightening his haunches. After a moment, his head cleared. He wandered past the dens Bristle and Runt shared. There, he smelled caches of game buried in the soft earth, but they were marked with powerful warning scents, so he did not dig them up. Farther out, a few gnawed-over carcasses were discarded to be scoured clean by lower-ranking scavengers. Pax began to poke through the carrion. Only the tail end of a marsh rat held any meat at all. Too rancid and gristly even for the crows. It was crawling with maggots. Pax lowered his head to the remains. He opened his jaw, but the smell sent him reeling back. This was not food. He staggered back a few steps and buried his muzzle in a patch of new clover, chewing the sprouts to cleanse the foul odor from his sensitive nasal passages. He swallowed and then began to feed, tentatively. The act of eating was a comfort to his shrunken belly, although a false one. The clover wouldn't strengthen him. After a few mouthfuls, the clear thought arose again. He must find his boy. Just then, he heard something tear through the grass. Before his sluggish senses could respond, he felt a solid weight plow into him. Runt pounced on top of Pax, crowing at his successful ambush. When Pax did not move to shake him off, Runt began to examine him. Pax lay still, while the smaller fox sniffed and licked him, too weak to waste energy batting him away. Unwell? Pax closed his eyes against the low-glancing sunlight and did not respond. Runt bounded off and came back a few minutes later, with a worm hanging from his jaw. He dropped it at Pax's paws. Pax shrank away, but the thoughts he'd had earlier surfaced again. He had to find his boy. He could avoid death if he ate. Pax picked up the worm and bit into it. Unused to the taste of live flesh, Pax retched and twisted away. Runt dug up another worm and dropped it in front of Pax, and this time Pax got to his feet and took a few steps before sinking back down. Runt followed and nudged him. Eat. Pax mustered as much dominance as he could. Leave. The younger fox gazed at the older one for a moment, then turned and trotted into the grass. Relieved, Pax laid his head on his paws. He did not have the energy for resistance now. But Runt reappeared after a few moments, something round in his mouth. He dropped his gift, and it broke open. Egg. The scent called up a sharp memory. Once, when he was very young, Pax had found a hard white orb while exploring his human's kitchen counter. He'd batted at it, thinking it was one of his boy's playthings. It had rolled onto the floor and cracked open, spilling its delicious secret. Peter's father had come in while he was still licking at the last drops and smacked him away. His flank had stung from the blow, but that egg had been worth it. Since then, Pax managed an exploratory visit to the kitchen counter every time he was left alone, looking for more of them. A few times, he'd gotten lucky. The quail egg Runt had brought was smaller, its speckled shell flecked with dried grass, and it smelled gamier than the ones his humans ate. But there was no mistaking it. Egg. Pax rose. Runt backed away to allow Pax to lap up the yoked prize. He licked the grass clean of every drop, then looked up, eager to express his gratitude. Runt was gone. But in a few moments he came back. Two more eggs held carefully in his mouth. Pax devoured them. Runt left and returned twice more. Pax ate steadily until finally, seven eggs swelling his shrunken belly taut, he dropped to the sandy apron in front of the dens and closed his eyes. Runt leaped onto a gnarled root above the dens. He drew himself up to his full height, and while Pax slept, the ragged little runt kept watch. Chapter 14. Peter recognized Vola's footsteps, the hard wooden stamp followed by the softer shoed footfall, and dropped the logs back into the wood bin. He braced himself in the cabin doorway, watching Vola pump water into the kitchen sink.
You stayed off that foot?
Pretty much. Actually, he'd gotten up at least a dozen times to do pull-ups on a beam, and he'd lifted logs for half an hour. His arms were sore, and his foot hurt a lot when it wasn't raised. But he hadn't been able to lie around doing nothing, knowing Pax was still out there. Vola began lathering up her hands without turning around.
You write that note?
Peter pulled the crutches to his sides. Already he felt more secure when they were tucked under his arms.
I did,
But no buts. You write once a week. The bus driver friend I told you about, Robert Johnson, I ask him, he'll mail them from different spots along his route. First condition, remember?
Peter tried a sharp turn, wobbled, but righted himself. He swung through another turn, smoother.
All right?
Okay.
Good.
Vola hung the dish towel on its peg, crossed to the fireplace, and began shredding newspaper onto the grate.
Let's move to the second condition, then. That charm bracelet you carry.
I'm guessing it was your mother's?
Why do you carry it with you? Why that particular thing?
Peter felt his body go instantly rigid, the way it always did whenever anyone asked about his mother. As if it had to freeze to decide whether it was okay to talk about her or not. Usually with strangers it wasn't, so he was surprised when his hands relaxed their grip on the crutches a little, and his throat eased open. She always wore it. She'd hold her wrist up so I could play with it when I was a baby. I don't remember that, but I've seen a picture.
I do remember her telling me about it, though.
About the charm, I mean. It's a phoenix. That's a special bird. It's red and gold and purple, colored like sunrise, and it
rises from the ashes. I know what a phoenix is.
Right.
But out of its own ashes.
That's the part my mom cared about.
Its own ashes?
When it gets worn out, it builds itself a nest high in a tree, away from everything.
Peter stopped.
It suddenly occurred to him that Vola's cabin felt like a nest. He circled on the crutches to look around. Yes. A secret protected nest, surrounded by trees, away from everything.
He turned back to Vola, who was cross-stacking kindling.
He hoped she hadn't read his mind.
So the phoenix fills the nest with its favorite stuff. Myrrh and cinnamon is what's in the story, I think. Then the nest ignites, burning the bird's old body. And the new bird rises up out of the old bird's ashes.
My mother loved that. She said it meant that no matter how bad things got, we could always make ourselves new again. Vola didn't respond. She touched a match to the shredded paper and watched as it caught fire. Her face looked grim in the light of the new flames. She added two logs, and then a third.
Go try those crutches outside while there's still some light, she said, without looking up.
Peter opened the front door and navigated the step, relieved to get away. He didn't have a clue what he'd said wrong. Living in the woods all alone probably made a person weird. But she was right, that he needed to practice outside. He'd lost a whole day now. A whole day. Maybe he did need some time to train and heal. But he was leaving as soon as he could. He left the cleared yard and headed to where the uneven ground was snarled with roots and brush. It took a torturously long time to circle the cabin. His second turnaround was a little faster, and by the fifth circuit, he felt almost comfortable. But he was bathed in sweat when he swung back inside. The cabin was quiet, except for the gentle crackling of the fire. Vola sat in an armchair, sewing something yellow. The quiet, and the way the setting sun seemed to wash the cabin in peace, as if everything were right with the world, suddenly felt mocking to Peter. Everything was wrong with the world. Another day had passed when Pax had been out there alone. Another night was coming when he would be cold, probably hungry and scared, too. And what if he hadn't found water? He took a lurching swing across the room. Halfway across, one crutch caught on a rug, and he had to stab the other into the wall to keep from crashing into a lantern. Shorter steps. You'll get the hang of them after a while. After a while? My fox will be dead in a while. He dropped the crutches and sank to the chair at the kitchen table. What's the point, anyway? How is this supposed to work out? Vola dropped her sewing. What do I look like? A magic eight ball? She went out to the porch
and came back with a bag of ice. Then she lifted Peter's foot to a chair and arranged the ice over it. I don't have your answers. The sight of his useless foot reminded him of everything he couldn't do now. He looked away. Why not? Aren't you supposed to be wise and all? Living out here by yourself, with all these... He threw his thumb toward the jumble of notes tacked on the board behind him. All these philosophy bingo cards. You're supposed to be wise, at least, aren't you? Or witchy, or something. Peter almost didn't recognize himself, back-talking the woman like this. He felt as if he were short-circuiting, as if his impulses were leaping directly out of him without passing through his brain. But once again, he wasn't where he should be. And now his foot was too wrecked to get him there, and Pax was still out there alone. Vola pulled the bucket out from a cupboard and set it in the sink. Philosophy bingo cards. She looked only mildly insulted. I'm trying to figure out my own life. I don't have your answers. So who does? And don't say my father because he's a little absent these days. Because he caused all this. Peter hardened his jaw against saying the words and forced himself to breathe slowly. He wasn't angry. He was just frustrated. Anyone would be. Sudden tears threatened. What was wrong with him lately? And he knuckled his eyes. Vola started over toward him, then seemed to change her mind. She backed away to lean against the kitchen counter. You are angry, she said simply, as if she were noting he had dark hair or the sun was going down. I'm not angry. But he forced his fists open and counted 10 slow breaths, fighting it the way he always did. Because what if he was like his father with that threatening kind of anger, the kind that was always simmering, the kind that could boil over at any time and hurt everyone in the way? The apologies afterward never healed the damage. He squeezed his eyes shut against the tears, still crowning. I'm not angry. It's just that I didn't choose it. I didn't choose for there to be a war. I didn't choose for my father to join up. I didn't choose to leave my home. I didn't choose to go to my grandfather's, and I sure didn't choose to abandon an animal I took care of for 5 years. You're a kid. You don't get a lot of choices. I'd be angry, too. Diableman angry. I told you I'm not angry! Peter gulped in a sob that somehow escaped as a twisted laugh. He was short-circuiting again. And you're in love with that word, you know. What are you talking about, boy? Diableman? What is it? A swear? You're in love with the word Diableman. His wiring felt totally fried. If we were in second grade, I'd tell you you're so in love with that word you should marry it. She squawked, a loud crow's caw. But you're right, she said. I should get down on one Diableman ruined knee and ask that word to marry me. You should, Peter agreed, kind of hysterical now. You should put a Diableman ring on its Diableman finger. He wiped his face off and watched Vola as she came over and took the seat across from him. My grandfather swore in his first language. It drove my grandmother crazy, because she didn't speak it. But she sang in Italian when she cooked, so... Vola lifted a finger to stroke the feathers bunched at her throat. I carry many traits, she said quietly. And then she went silent for a while, holding his gaze the whole time. In their silence, Peter felt they were saying something important. Something about the long, dark tunnel he felt narrowing around him. I was counting on finding Pax in a week. Maybe 10 days. He looked down at his foot. Now? Pax? That's his name? Means peace, you know. Peter knew that. Lots of people had told him. But that's not why I named him. First day I brought him home, I left him for a minute. Just a minute. So I could get him some food. When I got back, I couldn't find him.
He'd crawled into my backpack and fallen asleep. It had the word Paxton sewn on the label. I was 7 then, and I figured, Paxton, that's a good name. It had an X in it, like Fox, you know? But now... But now what? Now he's all alone because of a war. I let him go because of a war. War, not peace. What's that called? Irony? Whatever. Now it's a terrible name. He'll probably die because of a war. Maybe yes. Maybe no. He could survive. It's spring. Plenty of food, I'd think. Peter shook his head. Foxes teach their kits to hunt when they're about 8 weeks old. I found him way before that. He was maybe 2 weeks old, the vet figured. He could run across a dozen mice sitting up on little plates, and he probably couldn't catch them. All he's ever had is kibble and the scraps I'd let him swipe. Well, what kind of scraps? Anything he'd find out there? Peter shrugged. He's crazy for peanut butter. He likes hot dogs, loves eggs. No, unless he stumbles into someone's picnic, he'll starve. He'll find water, I figure, and he can probably go a week without food. But after that? Peter dropped his head to his hands. I let it happen. I didn't choose any of it. But I didn't fight it, either. I don't know why I didn't fight it. Except, of course, he did know. When his father had first dropped the order about Pax, Peter had steeled himself and said, No, I won't do it. But his father's eyes had flared with that flash-fire anger, and his fists had jerked up, stopping only at the last split second to knuckle Peter's cheek. In a gesture that carried enough threat to set Pax on growling alert. Peter's own fist had come up, and the rage he'd felt at his father had scared him more than the threat itself. He heard his grandfather's words now. Our apples don't fall far from the tree, and he felt sick and afraid all over again. He dropped his gaze to the worn pine table to hide the shameful headline he felt burning across his face. Vola reached over and cupped the top of his head with both hands. Peter froze. Except for an occasional attaboy, shoulder shake from his father, or a casual arm punch from one of his friends, no one had touched him since his mother. Vola paused, as though she knew he needed time. Then she pressed down firmly. It was a strange thing to do, but Peter didn't pull away, didn't move a muscle. Didn't even draw a breath. Because at that moment, her strong grip was the only thing keeping him from flying apart. Well, that's over now, she said. Isn't it? She rose. I may not have your answers, boy, but I do know one true thing about you. You need food. A lot of food. You're 12. You've slept out in the cold and you've got a bone to heal. I'm gonna set that bone now. Then I'm going to start cooking, and you're going to start eating, and neither one of us is going to stop until you say so. Got it? Peter's belly was suddenly a hollow, snarling crater. Yes, ma'am. I've got it. Vola rummaged under the sink and drew out a sack of plaster. Peter watched her sift some into the bucket, and then pump in some water. Then she brought over the thing she'd been sewing. Foot up. Vola propped a pillow under his knee and worked a quilted sleeve over his leg, like an open-toed sock. He recognized the yellow-checked material. He glanced into the bedroom to be sure. You cut up your quilt? I can always make another one. You need the cushioning. She took another section of quilt and stripped the batting off, then ripped the yellow calico into strips and dunked them into the plaster. Hold your foot at a 90-degree angle. Around and around his foot and ankle, halfway up his shin, she wrapped the strips. When she'd built a thick boot, she frosted it with more plaster. Don't move, not even your toes. Vola left for the porch and came back with her arms full. She set two iron skillets on burners, flipped a hunk of butter into each, and turned on the flames. She cracked a couple of eggs into a yellow bowl and started whisking in milk, then cornmeal. A cool breeze, fragrant with turned earth and frying butter, lifted against Peter. He looked at the sturdy cast drying, his foot safe inside now, wrapped in what used to be Vola's quilt. "I'm sorry. About how I've been." He tipped his head to her bulletin board.
"My philosophy bingo cards," she said with a nod. "No bat, Peter. Those are just things I figure to be true about the world. The universals. The important ones are the things I figure out to be true about me. I keep them somewhere else. Private."
"How come?"
"How come they're the important ones, or how come they're private?"
Peter shrugged. "Either. Both." He leaned back, waiting. Vola eyed him as she sawed a slice of ham joint and forked it into one of the frying pans. She dipped out 3 ladles of batter, poured them sputtering into the other pan, then set the bowl down.
"I'm going to tell you a story. When I got out of the service, I didn't remember a single true thing about myself. That's what training does. No more individuals, just pieces they can mold to their machine. I was lost my first day as a civilian. Lost. I went into a grocery store. I stared at all the choices, and I kept wondering who I was supposed to be buying groceries for. What filled this person's hungry belly? Gumbo or pie? Beans or bread? In the produce aisle, I broke down because I didn't remember a single thing about myself."
Vola went quiet then, her eyes closed.
"What happened?" Peter nudged after a moment. "What happened?"
"In the store. What happened in the store?"
"Oh." She turned back to the stove and flipped the Johnny cakes. "Peanut butter."
"Peanut butter happened?"
Vola tossed her hands into the air. "Peanut butter happened, and I was lucky it did. There I was, on the floor of the grocery store, dirty, red and white checked linoleum I will never forget, weeping, and I knew I wouldn't get up until I remembered what kind of food I liked." Vola stacked the Johnny cakes on a blue plate, then paused. Peter thought she might be drifting back to the memory of that grocery store floor. He was glad he hadn't seen something like that. A grown woman, sobbing on a dirty grocery store floor. A crazy lady with one lost leg. He felt suddenly protective, and hoped no one had laughed at her, and that she had gotten herself out okay.
"And?"
"Oh, and finally I did. I remembered my grandmother telling me that when I first discovered peanut butter sandwiches, I wanted one every day. So I got up from the floor, and I bought myself some peanut butter and bread. I filled my cart with peanut butter and bread because I decided I wasn't coming back until I knew for sure something else I liked to eat. And I was afraid that might be a long time." She added the ham to the plate, slapped on a scoop of applesauce, and brought it over to him along with a white pitcher of maple syrup. "Eat." Peter flooded the plate with syrup and loaded a fork. The cornmeal had a gritty crunch. The ham was smooth and salty against the sweet syrup. It was the best food he could remember eating.
"And was it?"
he asked, when he'd cleaned half the plate. "A long time before you remembered something else?" Vola pressed a finger to the drying cast.
"Almost set. Keep still a while longer."
She went back to the stove and carved more ham, and ladled more batter into the skillet. "It was. People around me, they called it PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder. From being in the war. And they were right, that I was sick. But I knew it wasn't being in the war, exactly. It was that in the war, I had forgotten everything that was true about myself. Post-traumatic forgetting who you are disorder. That's what I had. My grandfather was in a nursing home by then, and he was dying. I went out to his place. It had been my old home, too. My grandparents raised me for a couple of years to clean it out. It was the end of summer. The orchard was an untended mess, but there were still some peaches hanging on. And that was the second lucky thing that happened to me, after the peanut butter. Because I suddenly remembered. Lord, I had loved those peaches. I used to sneak out in the middle of the night to pick them. I'd sprawl on the grass underneath those trees with fireflies flashing all around, and katydids singing. A heap of peaches on my belly, and I'd eat them till the juice ran into my ears. I remember that so clearly. I could smell that memory. I could hear it. And I could taste it. But I couldn't figure out how that girl would be the same person who had put on a uniform, picked up a gun, and done the things I did in the war. So I reached up and picked one of those peaches, and I laid myself down on the grass and bit into it. And there I was. I found another little true piece of my old self. She brought the skillet over and stacked more Johnny cakes and ham onto his empty plate, then went back to the stove. Stop, Peter said.
Stop? Well, that's the end of the story anyway.
No, I mean this'll be enough food. Thank you. Peter wished again that his fox were under the table, wondered again if Pax was hungry, and then had the curious sense that he wasn't. That tonight, at least, Pax had food in his belly. So then what? He asked, after loading his fork. You were okay? Vola set the skillet in the sink and came back to sit across from him at the table. What a person likes to eat?
That's a detail.
I was so lost. I needed to find out all the true things about myself. The little things to the biggest of all. What did I believe in at my core? Peter figured he knew what was coming. Like war. Now you're anti-war, right? Vola steepled her fingers under her chin. That's a complicated thing. What I am is for telling the truth about it. About what it costs. People should tell the truth about what war costs. That's taken me a long time to figure out. She leaned back. And that was just one thing. I had to relearn everything that was right and wrong for me. But I couldn't. The world was too loud for me to hear myself think. So I moved into my grandfather's place. I decided to stay there until I knew who I was again. Peter looked up at the jarred peaches on the shelf above him, then recalled the blooming trees in the orchard. And you're still here, he said. This is that place, isn't it? Chapter 15. The sun burned through a dawn fog. The two foxes had been traveling for hours, but Gray was slow and rested often, so they had only just reached the valley basin. For the most part, Pax respectfully flanked the older fox, but sometimes he broke away to race at full speed for long, glorious minutes before circling back. He had never run before. Not really. He'd sprinted around the borders of his pen or across the yard, but this running was a different thing. Neat oval paws heeled now, skimming the ground only for traction as he galloped faster and faster over great sweeps of grass. Yesterday's meal had cleared his senses and fueled his muscles. But now the eggs were gone from his belly, and the smells of the warming valley brought on a powerful hunger. Where the humans were, there would be food. How far?
2 days' travel. Gray described a place of old stone walls where the earth smelled faintly of tar and hemp, bordered by a river. We will reach it by dusk. The human settlements are another day's travel beyond that.
Pax did not remember human settlements. He did not remember a river. Of his home, he remembered the looming door. He remembered oaks ringing the house. The overgrown remains of a flower garden he was never allowed into. The sounds of a road.
He sensed that other humans lived along this road, but he had never encountered them. These memories were fading, as was the memory of being caged. He could no longer recall what the sky looked like through hexagons of cage wire. He remembered his boy, though. The hazel eyes with their odd, round pupils. The way Peter would close them and throw his head back and yelp something near a bark when he was delighted. His salty neck that smelled sometimes of sweat and sometimes of soap. His hands always moving with their scent of chocolate, which Pax loved, and of mitt leather, which he loathed. As the two foxes traveled on, Pax reflected on the puzzle of the other scent of his boy. His underlying scent. It hung between grief and yearning, and it welled from a deep ache for something that Pax could never divine. Sometimes, in the boy's nest room, this grief-yearning scent was so strong that it overpowered everything else. And yet his boy made no move to acquire whatever it was he wanted so badly. Whenever Pax caught that scent, he would hurry from wherever he was to find Peter flung across his bed, clutching the objects he kept hidden in the bottom drawer of his bureau, his face set in hard ridges. Pax would nose Peter's shirt sleeve, or claw up the curtains, then pretend to lose his footing and fall to the floor. Anything to get his boy to play. But when the grief-yearning scent was strongest, none of his tricks would work. On those days, Peter would shoo Pax outside and shut the door. Remembering this, Pax felt the urge to run again, but not for the joy of it. This war that is coming, are you sure it will harm all in its path? Even the youth.
Everything. It will destroy everything.
Pax nosed Gray, respectful but urgent. They must hurry. The older fox studied the younger one for a moment, then began to trot. They crossed the marshy seam of the valley and climbed the rocky cliffs, shoulder to shoulder this time. At the top of the rise, the two foxes stopped. Gray was panting hard. Ahead, the pines towered up, promising long, cool pools of shade. But the markings here were strong. The challenger hunted this territory, and the threat in his scent was unmistakable. And almost immediately, the ground beat with the light staccato of paws tearing toward them. Pax and Gray had barely braced themselves when the tawny fox burst from the underbrush, lips curled in a snarl, tail lashing. Pax shrank back, but Gray advanced calmly, his body lowered enough to declare non-aggression.
"We are only passing through."
The challenger ignored the peaceful greeting and sprang, hitting the old fox hard in the flank and pinning him down. Then sank his teeth into Gray's thin neck. At Gray's pain scream, Pax's guard hairs lifted and his heartbeat quickened. His muscles thrummed with a fury he'd known only once. In the early days with his humans, the father had raised a hand to the boy, and Pax had shot across the room without thought, small kit teeth tearing fiercely through the man's pant leg. Now, as it had then, his back arched and a low growl rumbled deep in his throat. The challenger spun around in surprise, and Pax charged him headlong. They rolled, teeth clipping at tender ears, hind claws digging for purchase in soft belly fur. The yellow fox was more skilled, but Pax's fighting was fueled by an instinct to protect. When his teeth found the other's throat, the challenger scrambled to his feet and backed off, whimpering. Pax leaped in front of Gray, shielding him as he'd shielded his boy that long ago time, lifted his chest and growled a warning. The challenger slunk away. Pax shook off the blood from a dozen superficial scratches and then cleaned Gray's wound. The puncture was deep. He urged Gray to go back.
"No, I will travel."
The two padded steadily for an hour through light woods, Pax restraining himself to keep pace with the ailing Gray, relieved at least that they kept moving. But when a murder of crows landed in the bare arms of a pecan tree, Gray doubled back and sat down at its base, ears pricked up intently at the commotion. Pax waited, not patiently. After a moment, the old fox barked for him.
The war is moving closer.
How do you know this?
The crows. Listen.
Pax cocked his head. More shrieking birds swept in, descending into the lower branches, then flapping up again to higher perches in a cyclone of distress. They're upset. The crows hulked their shoulders, spiked their feathers,